I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A terrific new read is the e-book from the author John Higgs. It's called Our Pet Queen, A New Perspective on Monarchy. I'll get Mr. Higgs, who joins me now, to tell us about how he's come to argue that the monarchy is by far the best system, yet there's a new way to view these royals as our pets. It's a fun read, and you can get it for your Kobo or on Amazon. It's published by Signal. John Higgs is the author of The 20th Century and Alternative History, as well as of The Brandy of the Damned, I Have America Surrounded, and The KLF. He's also a television producer. He was raised in Wales and lives in Brighton, England, where he joins me from today. Please welcome to the Plateau of Lent program, John Higgs. Mr. Higgs, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So you're Welsh. How much of that?
I'm raised in Wales.
Oh, I
and
see.
I'm actually born in the Midlands in England.
Ah.
So I'm English, but I think like a Welshman.
So what is the thinking of a Welshman when it comes to the crown?
Very unimpressed, essentially. And, you know, I grew up with the idea that power being hereditary and that a certain individual are born with some quality of superiority over others was just an absurd idea. I never thought for 1 minute I'd write a book that turned out to be a pro-monarchy book.
So growing up, when you saw, say, the royals on television or the sort, I mean, what did that stir up in you? Did you feel that the deference showed was a little silly?
I did, but what I've come to realize, having written this e-book, is that I was only offended intellectually. You know, emotionally, I didn't quite feel the rage. I'd have to talk myself up into being annoyed by them. And that was quite odd, I thought. I wondered why that was. And so when I started to write this e-book, which just started as a joke, really. It was just a one-line gag about the monarchy being our pets because, you know, we spend far too much money on them and we should have got some of the spare ones and used it. It was just a little throwaway lie. But once I'd written that, it sort of stuck with me. And the more I sort of used that to look at the monarchy, the more it sort of revealed an awful lot about the nature of the head of state and you know, just how irrational we are and things like that. And it's by far my best way of understanding the monarchy now. It's the best model that I can come up with.
So then is the book, for people listening to us who haven't read it, is it, say, a précis as to how to get a better monarchy, perhaps?
No, it's a statement that what we have now works and is totally nuts. And when you think about it, that's not bad. That's not too bad.
Yeah, because people complain about the monarchy, just that it just costs too much. It looks ostentatious. It looks silly.
Mm.
And
it's just the same with keeping pets. You know,
yeah.
They cost too much. We spend far too much money on them. We shouldn't, but we do. It's a flaw in human nature, I guess. And it would be great if they were much cheaper. But once you start to view them, I mean, the thing with the monarchy is the narrative that surrounds them. Is that there are betters, you know, there are superiors.
Yeah.
And you can accept that narrative if you like, you know, but there are plenty more narratives you can choose. And I think the idea if we just view them as our pets is far healthier. And you get less annoyed, you get less irate about the whole thing, and you can even get a little bit of pleasure out of them.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, how when we see a new royal baby or something, or we see a wedding, you know, we think it's whatever we think of the monarchy, whether they're just celebrities or you know, people on our money that we've seen grown up over the years, you do stop and you do stare. I mean, it's like a car accident,
yeah,
even, isn't it?
It's like if your neighbor, if their dog has puppies or something like that,
yeah.
Everyone in the street sort of comes along to have a look.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just brings people together, and it's a nice thing, you know, I'm obviously very grateful that I'm not a royal baby. I mean, that would be an awful, you know, start to life. I don't know. I'd hate to be royal. You just have no freedom. Your life is prescribed. You can't go off and become the person you're supposed to be. There's an argument that keeping a monarchy is cruel. But you can't deny that when a new one is born, people come together and it's a bonding thing.
Yeah. What's your assessment of Elizabeth II as queen?
Oh, she's a great queen. You know, I don't... Even the most hardcore Republicans, begrudgingly admit that she's quite a good queen and that she never meddles, you know. She never attempts to exert any unearned power that should be democratic power from the people in a political position. She's just always there, reliable, and regal. She's quite regal, you know. A head of state is essentially quite an irrational thing. It's quite absurd. The idea that one human being is a symbolic personification of a territory or a political structure or a population, I mean, that's magical thinking, you know. That's not rational in any way. The idea of a head of state is odd in itself. But she's very good at being that odd thing, I think.
Yeah, and she isn't, I guess, prey for gossip or anything like that, say, than lesser royals have been. I mean, you can't really fault her for anything, really. I mean, you know, she's not pushy or anything like that, say, as some of the other folks over the years that are part of her family.
That's right, yes, because Charles, I mean, when you've got a monarchy that's 1,000 years old, you get used to the idea that there are good ones and there are bad ones. And if you happen to be living for a period with a bad monarch, then at least you can sort of see the humour in it and just wait for it to sort of get over. Charles, I don't think anyone is expecting to be a good monarch like his mother is. There's a political scandal that's always threatening to break over here, which hasn't quite broken yet. There's a number of newspapers who are trying to use the Freedom of Information Act to get access to all the letters that he's been writing to government ministers to exert pressure, which is, you know, unearned pressure in a democratic sense on policies, and he's a major landowner, and it looks very dodgy, like he's been exerting pressure on a political process for his own benefit, you know, and that's totally crossed over the line. Queen Elizabeth, you didn't never expect to do anything like that.
Yeah.
The monarchy as it stands now is a constitutional monarchy. They have no power. They're a figurehead. They're an idea. That's what they should be. So, you know, when Elizabeth dies, there's going to be this really awkward period where people are trying to work out whether we have to stick with Charles for a few years and wait for him to die and just sort of twiddle our thumbs, or whether we sort of go, no, hang on, he's no good, we'll just have to move on to William or change it in some way like that. I strongly suspect, being British, we'll just all just put a crown on Charles's head and just sort of look at the floor and twiddle our thumbs for a few years.
You write in the book too about the French experience with monarchy, and what they've done. You also look in the book as to what the Australians have done in terms of the debates that they've had. They've had a referendum as well.
Yeah, sure.
There are people around the world who are thinking about their relationship with the crown, with monarchy.
But generally, it's phrased in the sense of, how can we get a more rational way of selecting the person who's going to be our head of state? That argument doesn't really recognise that a head of state itself is inherently irrational. You know, trying to find a rational way to get a head of state is like trying to sort of argue that like water should be dry. It's a category error. It's just sort of missing the point. Sort of arguing that maybe you could have an election every 5 years and crown a popular politician from days before. It's not what being a head of state is about. You know, a head of state is, as I say, it's a personification of a people or a nation or whatever. And it comes from deep within our neurological sort of evolution, this way where we see faces in clouds and we personify, we can't help it. When you're evolving in the jungle, you needed to know what things were not going to move, like the rocks were no trouble, but things that moved, active agents, you had to pay attention to. They might be trying to eat you, or they might be trying to give you food, our brains evolved to get very good at understanding things as active agents. And so as we evolved, we started and encountered things like, you know, love or war or wisdom or abstract concepts. We couldn't help it, we just personified them. They became, you know, the god Mars or the god Venus or things like that. It's just the way the brain works. And when we got into the era of nation states, we did exactly the same thing. We just have to project a human face on a collection of people, and that's what the head of state is. You know, it's not a sensible thing, but it is how we are. It is, you know, how we think. So that's why we do it, I guess.
So how has the monarchy reacted to the decline, say, in religion in your country? Do you think there's a relationship there with how the monarchy is viewed and how people have, say, lost their faith, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, it is a tough one. Being a symbolic representation of a people historically has been linked to a major religious role. You know, pharaohs, for instance, were the king, but they're also divine, also the god. The Japanese emperor up until World War II was a politician, but also a divinity. They have been very, very sort of intertangled. And a lot, the establishment of the Anglican Church of Henry VIII, you know, splitting with Rome, was much more about taking a religious power from one geographical point and moving it home, you know, taking it from Rome and then moving it back to London. So the monarchy has been very much sort of tied up with that. But it's a much more of a secular age, you know, so Britain is very secular. I mean, it sort of pretends to be religious just not to, you know, annoy people.
Yeah.
But you never meet anyone who goes to church or anything like that. And I think this monarchy has adapted quite well to that. You know, we're very much interested in celebrities and our role models are famous, things like that. They've slipped from being not religious figures, but certainly elevated figures, into becoming celebrities quite well, I think.
And do you think the monarchy would do better if, say, the royal family projected themselves as more human?
No, I think they need to be more like pets.
Yeah.
We need to be. I mean, there was a story recently. There's a little scandal over here where our Prime Minister, David Cameron, was recorded speaking to the Mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, saying how he'd been on the phone to the Queen, and when she found out the result of the Scottish referendum, she purred. She almost purred, he said. Which I think just totally proves my point. They're becoming more and more like pets. I'm fully expecting, Charles to start yapping like a spaniel any day now.
Would you tell us about Dennis the cat?
Yeah, he's actually on the sofa next to me.
Ah.
I hate to insult my cat publicly because my daughter gets quite, you know, offended by the whole thing. But he's not a nice red cat at all.
Ah.
If you came to visit, he'd look at you and then he'd start scratching. He's not affectionate. He was watching our cat and the role he has in our house. That made me realise that this is similar to the role of the monarchy in the body politic, I guess, in the country. You know, it's a strange, almost begrudging affection you get for this thing that, you know, is taking up all your money, and really rationally you'd be a lot better off without it or without him. But still, you just find it just becomes a part of your life that gives you a strange pleasure. And which is, you know, having a monarchy sort of runs throughout your entire life. It's always there. It's sort of like it's like a slow motion soap opera directed by Baz Luhrmann. It's just a strange story bubbling away in the corner. And everyone you knows the story, so it sort of binds people like that. And everyone in our family sort of knows what the cat is like, and it sort of it binds us in that way. So that's why, in the end, I dedicated the ebook to Dennis the Cat.
How much of the recent Scottish referendum was about the crown itself?
The Spanish referendum? Are you talking about?
The Scottish referendum.
Oh, the Scottish.
Yeah.
Well, no, that she was the crown was completely above it. All the Scottish nationals, the SNP, their policy was we'll keep the Queen. That's got nothing to do with this. It's a pure political referendum. And that makes sense historically, because the union of Scotland and England, or Scotland to the United Kingdom, was originally an idea of a Scottish king who became the King of England as well, in the union of the crowns, which predated the 1707 political union. It was kind of nice, but the royal family just hovered all about it and didn't say anything, and there was no... It never dipped into sort of political sort of, you know, because it's quite divided now, Scotland, because they voted, you know, 45-55, and it was very passionate on both sides, and it's quite a divided country. There's a lot of anger still up there. There's a lot of people casting accusations at the other half of the population, and the fact that the monarchy just bubbles above it is something that can just start bringing people back together slightly. It's a sort of a shared thing.
So you don't buy the argument that the announcement of the new baby, the expected baby, I should say, of William and Kate, had anything to do with the referendum?
No. I would be very surprised if they got a memo with the date of the Scottish referendum and worked back 9 months. Mm-hmm. Did it all for political reasons. That would surprise me. Mind you, they are odd, so I wouldn't say I'm 100% certain it didn't happen, but it would be very odd.
Well, was this an enjoyable book for you to write? I mean, it seems like it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. I've mainly been writing for the same publisher, for Random House.
Mm-hmm.
This alternative history of the 20th century, which is out, I think, in April in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
That was a hard book to write. That was just the amount of research. Not so much the stuff that was in there, but I had to read around everything, just to make sure everything back to the context of everything. It's a book I'm very proud of, and I can't wait for you to see it.
Yeah.
But after writing it, I just wanted to do something that had a bit more mischief. You know, and the publisher said, look, we've just got these short e-books for a couple of dollars. Any chance you could do with something, about 15,000 words, 20,000 words or something. And it was just an excuse just to sort of take an idea that was inherently absurd when you first look at it, but then just slowly realise that, well, actually, that probably makes more sense than the regular narrative.
Yeah. Well, it's a great read. I hope a lot of people pick it up, and it's been such fun talking to you today, John. Congratulations on it. Good luck with it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. The book is called Our Pet Queen, A New Perspective on Monarchy. It's from Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. John Higgs, its author, joined me on the line from Britain in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.